Welcome to episode number 45 of the Banking Litigation Podcast. Chilly evenings must mean that spring has sprung in England, in London. So from a very cold EC2A, good morning and welcome to my co-host, Kerry. Hello, Kerry.
Hi, John. Hello, listeners.
Kerry's actually wearing a woolly pulley today, indicating how cold it is. And we're joined today by our ace of counsel, banking litigator champion, Mark Tanner. Hello again, Mark, seasoned pro at Banking Litigation Podcast.
Good morning, John and Kerry, and hi, podcasters.
Yeah, and look, before we get stuck in, a special thank you to the podcasters, in particular the two in New Zealand, who recently dropped us a line to thank us for running the podcast. Welcome and good evening from London to New Zealand. Okay. From spring to a spring onion, let me bounce into our first case of the day, which is Veg Essentials, thank you, Kerry, and Shanghai Commercial and Savings Bank, where the High Court examined a claim against a bank for fraudulent misrepresentations made by its former corporate relationship manager. Now, the court found that the bank was vicariously liable on the basis that the employee of the bank had apparent authority to make the representations which had been relied upon by the claimant.
Now, John, just before springing into the facts, just as a clarification for our listeners, apparent or ostensible authority is when an agent can bind a principal to a third party based on the principal's representation of the agent's authority. So it's when the principal gives the agent authority which appears wider than the agent's actual authority.
Yes, that's quite right, Mark. Sorry, I was buzzing, well, the script says buzzing ahead with eagerness. The only bee I've seen, Kerry, this year has been dead, died of the cold. So anyway, yeah, sorry, Mark, I was buzzing ahead with eagerness here. The decision is actually quite an important reminder. If an employee's position and actions give the appearance of authority, a financial institution may be held liable for the employee's fraudulent misrep, even where the employee's actions are outside the scope of their actual authority.
Thanks, John. So that's all clear, but in cases like this...
Clear as ice, right?
Clear as the ice that's on the ground in SW19. But I do think in cases like this, it will always come down to the detail of the employee's position and also the facts suggesting that they had authority to do what they did. So can you share some of the context of this case with us?
Absolutely, Kerry. Sorry for sliding ahead. So the claimant company, in seeking funding for the development of a health drink, received a fraudulent proof of funds letter from an employee at the defendant bank, SCSB. Now, the letter falsely confirmed that a third party had sufficient funds to invest in the health drink venture. And importantly, the letter was on SCSB's letterhead. It contained an authentic SCSB stamp and was signed by the former employee as a customer relationship manager. Now, the sale fell through, as you might expect, when it was revealed that the funds were non-existent, leading to the collapse, sadly, of the claimant's health drink business and the conviction of the SCSB employee on fraud charges. Now, the claimant commenced proceedings against the bank, seeking damages for the fraudulent misrepresentations in the letter because it had lost the chance of securing investment from another potential investor.
And I'm assuming, John, that the bank accepted that the misrepresentations were fraudulent, given that the employee was convicted of fraud.
Yes, quite. So the question before the court here was whether SCSB, the bank, was vicariously liable, and this depended on whether the employee had actual authority to sign and send the letter, or whether SCSB allowed it to appear so, i.e. whether the employee had ostensible authority.
So I suspect that this decision clarifies the correct test for determining vicarious liability for an agent's deceit. Is that right, John?
As ever, Kerry, one step ahead, watch you don't slip. The judgment confirms that the correct test is per Armagas and Mundogas, which states that a principal will be liable where they hold out to the claimant that the agent had actual or apparent authority to do what they did. And it must be established that the principal intended to hold out the agent in this way and that the claimant, in fact, acted on that. So taking all that and applying it to the facts of this case, the court said that the employee's position as an appointed customer relationship manager of the bank their use of the bank's letterhead and stamp were sufficient to give them apparent authority. And on the balance of probabilities, the court thought that the claimant was in fact induced to rely upon the letter and that the letter was the substantial cause of any claimed loss. And therefore, the court found in favour of the claimant.
Thanks, John. And there is, of course, a link to the blog post in our show notes. I should say, I was quite disappointed that we didn't get to have a new health drink on the market. I'm always looking out for a new brand. Veggie Central sounded like quite a good name.
I drink, Kerry, every evening. I have a glass of healthy vegetable drink. It's called red wine. Or the fruit drink, I think.
I was going to say fruit. If we're going into a classification,
all,
I think.
It's all the same stuff. It's all good.
Grapes. One of your five a day.
A potato lager or something.
In Dorset, Kerry, I could bring you a bottle of milk vodka. They make it in southern Dorset. I will send you a link in the show notes.
But bring it along to the next podcast recording.
We'll do that.
It'll be a bit more fun.
Moving on, breezing into our next segment. I believe, Mark, if you're still with us, you have a couple of cross-border trade finance decisions for us.
I do, and I am. Thanks, John. Yes, I've got a couple of bountiful decisions for our listeners, and both cases point towards the trend that the English court will take steps to respect and protect parties' choice of English law and or jurisdiction in trade finance documentation, which I think is pretty good news from our perspective. So the first up is Macquarie Bank versus Banque Cantonale Vaudoise, and the claim revolves around two standby letters of credit issued by the defendant, which is a Swiss bank. Now, due to a default in the underlying trade agreement, the claimant, Macquarie Bank, demanded payment under the standby letters of credit and subsequently issued proceedings against the defendant in England, seeking declarations as to its entitlement to enforce them. It's worth noting that the letters of credit were subject to the ICC Uniform Customs and Practice for Documentary Credit 600.
Ah, UCP 600, Mark, as I'm holding up to you, I know it very well.
Yes, it is indeed, John. And the agreements provided for English law, but did not specify a jurisdiction clause. And so the defendant challenged the jurisdiction of the English court based on the doctrine of forum non conveniens.
Let me interrupt you there, Kerry. That's originally a Scots law doctrine that was incorporated into English law. The leading case used to be, and this is off the top of my head, Lord Gough's speech in the Spiliada. Cancellates around about 1982.
It is Spiliada. You're right. 10 points to John, gold star.
I wasn't.
Competing. Right, yeah, so forum non conveniens. So this is where the English court may decline jurisdiction on the ground that there's a court in another jurisdiction which is clearly more a more suitable forum for the trial of the action in the interest of all the parties and in the justice of the case. So is that summary right, Mark?
Yes, 10 points to you, Kerry. So I'm now 10 behind both you and John. So the defendant attempted to rely on close links with Switzerland in the underlying transaction and ongoing parallel Swiss civil and criminal proceedings that were commenced prior to the English claim.
Interesting. And did the English court accept the defendant's position, Mark?
No, it didn't. The High Court dismissed the jurisdictional challenge, finding that England and Wales was the most appropriate forum for the dispute. And in doing so, the court emphasised that by choosing English law, the parties had intended that the transaction would benefit from the protection of certain substantive characteristics in trade finance, which have important procedural consequences, and that these rights would be compromised if the litigation proceeded in Switzerland, whereas the English court is well placed and willing to protect these characteristics and implications.
So what sort of, quote, substantive characteristics did the court refer to, Mark?
Well, one to highlight, John, is the absolute obligation on the bank to pay, irrespective of any wider dispute between the parties, save for exceptional circumstances.
So the court felt that the Swiss civil proceedings would not give effect to the absolute obligation to pay?
Exactly. This was because the defendant had been able to prevent the standby letters of credit being enforced in Switzerland because third-party investigations into a potential fraud was taking place, even though the defendant had no fraud case against the claimant itself, and there was no suggestion that the claimant had any knowledge of fraud. And it was on this basis that the court held that England and Wales, where the court's procedure would be applied in a manner compatible with those substantive rights, was the forum in which the case could most suitably be tried.
It sounds like the High Court's decision is a bit of a breath of cool spring air for those seeking to enforce standby letters of credit governed by English law. Look, certainly the judgment seeks to avoid undermining the certainty and reliability of these instruments in international trade.
So just to pause, I'm going to dock John some points, because during Mark trying to cover this case, John has been repeatedly holding up the UCP 600 leaflet.
Well, if Kerry, if you give me a TV show rather than a podcast, and our podcasters would have seen it. So I'm just saying, you know, it would have been helpful.
To a video instead.
Yes.
Sorry, Mark.
No. John needs a bigger stage. Very worthy of it. But yes, the decision is a good decision, and it leads me nicely onto my second case, which continues the trend. And that case is Afghanistan International Bank versus Yes Bank, and looking at the enforceability of counter guarantees. And in that case, the Afghan bank's entitlement to enforce guarantees provided by the Indian bank, Yes Bank. And in that instance, the contracts were both governed by English law and contained an English jurisdiction clause.
So having read our blog post, Mark, I'm aware that the Bombay High Court granted interim injunctions prohibiting payment under the counter guarantees. So did the English court still assert its jurisdiction despite this?
It did indeed, Kerry. The English court granted limited declaratory relief, confirming the exclusive jurisdiction of the English court. And it was persuaded that the declaration would assist the Indian court in determining that it did not have jurisdiction over the counter guarantees.
Interesting, Mark. But did this not create some sort of ripples in judicial comity between the courts?
Not in this instance, John. The court was also persuaded that it was not an infringement on the principle of comity between courts for it to grant the declaratory relief as to the meaning and effect of provisions of a contract which was governed by English law and was between parties before the court.
Interesting. Thanks, Mark. And as always, our listeners can find links to both of those blog posts in our show notes.
Well, now, podcasters, although Easter seems a long time ago, I hope you had a good Easter or spring break. Kerry, Mark, good Easter holiday?
Yeah, we were skiing, which was marginally warmer than it is now in the UK in April.
And ours was lovely. Kids and I went to Egypt, which was a lot warmer than England in April.
I have to thank the good people of Obertauern near Salzburg in Austria for putting up with me for another week. They are the most wonderfully hospitable people, and the Wiener Schnitzel at 5,000 feet is particularly tasty. So I would commend the Hotel Schneider in Obertauern to all of our podcasters, although don't make it too busy because I still want to be able to afford to go. Super. Okay, well, look, back home, aren't we? Kerry, I think you've got a case on your favourite topic.
Thanks, John. I do indeed. So today I will be running us through the latest court decision on authorised push payment or APP fraud in the case of CCP Graduate School and NatWest and Santander.
That sounds a lot like Quincecare, Kerry. You can't seem to get away from Quincecare.
No, apparently not, Mark. Although in the APP fraud context, the Quincecare duty is so 2023, and a new alleged duty appears to have hatched this year in the form of something called the retrieval duty.
Yeah, I was going to say, Kerry, I think Quincecare is a bit old hat. The Supreme Court in Philip and Barclay said that Quincecare was no longer arguable in the case of APP fraud.
Absolutely right, John. But the CCP case looked at whether a sending or a receiving payment service provider, I'm going to refer to as a PSP, owes a duty directly to the victim of the fraud to take reasonable steps to retrieve or recover the sums paid out as a result of the APP fraud, which is different to Quincecare, which looks at whether or not the bank should make the payment in the first place.
Got it. Okay, I know you said this was a novel duty, Kerry, but there's something about this in the Philip and Barclay's judgment, isn't there?
Ah, good memory, John. Bump you back up on the points. So in Philip and Barclay's, the Supreme Court actually granted permission for Mrs. Philip to maintain an alternative claim based on the PSP's alleged failure to take adequate steps after it was alerted to the fraud. And that was even though the court considered that the likelihood of successfully reclaiming the money under that kind of claim, under that kind of action, was in fact very slim. But in doing so, the Supreme Court left the door ajar for claims based on some sort of retrieval duty. And in CCP, the court considered this novel duty, as I said, against both the sending and receiving PSPs. And then both banks applied for reverse summary judgment or strikeout on the basis that, in fact, there is no such duty of retrieval.
And what did the court find in this instance, Gary?
Well, Mark, it's a bit of a split decision. The court summarily dismissed the claim against the sending bank on the basis that it was statute barred under the Limitation Act 1980.
And in respect of the claim against the receiving bank?
Well, here the court refused to strike out the claim, and this was because the underlying facts meant that there were still sums left in the receiving PSP's account on the relevant date for limitation purposes. And in the absence of any limitation argument, the court thought that the retrieval duty was arguable. In its view, the Supreme Court in Philip recognised that there could be a duty of retrieval. On balance, the court concluded that there was some uncertainty as to whether the retrieval duty could be owed by the bank of those who have perpetrated the APP fraud. And on this basis, the court felt it could not strike out the claim.
So how does all this sit with the rationale in Philip that the reimbursement model for victims of APP fraud is a question for social policy, for regulators and the government, and not a role for the courts?
Well, it doesn't sit very well at all, John, particularly when there's a new mandatory reimbursement requirement coming into force in October this year, which will apply to both sending and receiving PSPs.
And Kerry, will the reimbursement requirement override all of this anyway, so that this decision won't actually have much impact?
Now, I like your thinking there, Mark. I think the problem is that if the courts find that there is an actual legal duty on banks to recover sums paid out, then this could move the dial on the risks for banks relating to historic APP fraud. It's worth adding that another interesting angle to all of this, which we've been speaking to our clients about, are the potential risks arising from new draft legislation allowing PSPs to delay the processing of payments where it appears that there has been fraud or dishonesty. That's the Payment Services Amendment Regulations 2024, if you want to have a look. Under the new legislation, the PSPs will have up to 4 business days to process payments where there are, quote, reasonable grounds to suspect fraud, and there may be risks for firms which delay processing payments in order to investigate, where customers then seek to challenge the delayed payment on the basis that the firm actually had no reasonable grounds to suspect fraud.
Quite a lot of interesting and different angles to think about, but as ever, podcasters, please do feel free to contact us if you've got any questions about these developments, and there's of course a link to our blog post in the show notes. It actually says here, reach out to us, but unless you're a member of the Four Tops, you can just contact us. Right, okay, last but not least, let's end the podcast with a few quickfire legislative and procedural updates. First up, on 19th of March, the Litigation Funding Agreements Enforceability Bill, try and say that 3 times quickly, was introduced to Parliament. This follows the government's announcement that it would introduce legislation to reverse the effect of the high-profile decision in PACCAR last July.
And what changes does the new bill propose, John?
Well, the new bill amends Section 58AA of the Courts and Legal Services Act, looks like it's been amended already a couple of times, which defines a DBA. And the amendment provides that an agreement is not a DBA if, and to the extent that it is a, quote, litigation funding agreement, close quote. This is defined as an agreement where a funder funds a litigant's legal fees or the payment of an adverse costs order in return for some form of payment to the funder. And most important to note, the amendment is said to have retrospective effect, so it would remove existing funding agreements from the definition of a DBA and therefore from the ambit of PACCAR.
Quite a significant change. So what else is the government considering in this area?
Well, that's not enough for you, Kerry. OK, right. The government is also considering options for a wider review of litigation funding sector, and the Justice Minister has written to the Civil Justice Council inviting it to undertake that review, which would aim to ensure that claimants can get the best deal, that's another quote, and that the review will expressly consider the need for further regulation or safeguards.
And then moving on, John, I believe you have an update for us on public access to court documents.
Yes, indeed, Mark. The Civil Procedure Rule Committee is consulting on a revised Rule 5.4C. Now, it's currently drafted. This would lead to parties' witness statements, expert reports and skeleton arguments becoming public at a much earlier stage of proceedings than is currently the case.
Interesting. So what's the current position, John?
Well, it's quite interesting. And I should say we've got quite a few clients who are quite vocal in their comments about the draft change. At the moment, the only documents non-parties are able to obtain automatically from the court file under Rule 5.4C without the court's permission are the statements of case and any judgments or orders made in public. The rules also separately provide that witness statements are open to inspection during trial once the witness has been called to give evidence, and skeleton arguments are often provided at trial voluntarily in any event. Non-parties can apply to the court for permission to obtain any other category of document at the moment, and the court has discretion to provide access, but in general, documents will not be available to the public where the case has settled before a hearing. So the proposed new rule makes quite radical changes. And finally, to wrap up our spring podcast, Kerry's asked me to do a little promo for an article we published in the Journal of International Banking Law and Regulation on the implications of sanctions against Russia on banking disputes in the UK. And the article explores the willingness demonstrated by the English court to allow contractual obligations to be fulfilled in ways which do not contravene applicable sanctions regimes, but which may go beyond the scope of a strict approach to the agreement of the parties. And a link to all these updates can be found in the show notes, I think, Kerry?
Yes, that's correct. And also we'll put in a link to our very recently published banking litigation update, which provides...
Is that the one that does have a video?
Which does have a video. Rupert Lewis, our head of banking litigation, and I have recorded a little video for that publication, a bit of banking litigation TV, summarising the key developments and themes over the past 6 months. And then the full written update has a summary of each of the different developments and cases and updates that have taken place over that period, and then with links off to all of our detailed analysis. So it's a really good compendium of everything that's happened in the last half year.
Almost as good as the podcast. One day, Kerry, one day, maybe you'll give me a TV show as well. Well, there we are. Look, thank you very much in particular to our visitor, Mark, for contributing today. Kerry, thank you as ever. And in a sort of slightly bizarre turn, thank you, Noor behind the glass, who's suffering from hay fever, even though it's Baltic outside. So the worst combinations of the English spring. Thank you all podcasters for joining. We look forward to speaking to you when the weather gets a little bit warmer, one hopes, next month. Thank you very much and take care.